I always wanted to work. I can remember being 11, 12 years old, jealous of older kids who had summer jobs, bored out of my mind from watching hours of television. I wanted a job, but I was too young. I thought it was cool. I wanted money in my pocket to buy, well, back then, cassette tapes and then eventually records. When I did start working, it was at the CNE, the Canadian National Exhibition, in Toronto, cutting fish in a back room for a fish and chip stand that is still there to this day, working 12-hour shifts. I guess they say, be careful what you wish for. I immediately realized that it sucked. I can still remember the exacting angle I would place the knife to cut the frozen fish and the smell that stayed on me during days off. Luckily, it didn't last very long. I quit right before the CNE closed. I had to find a better job. Back then, Exhibition Stadium, the venue attached to the CNE, was pretty much the premier outdoor summer concert spot. The first Lollapalooza was there. I saw Metallica and Aerosmith and Billy Idol and Slayer there. But the one show I always wish I saw but couldn't because I was cutting fucking fish in a stinky back room was when an up-and-coming band from LA called Guns N' Roses opened up for the Cult. I still remember hearing the show over the sizzle of the cutlets and fries, wishing I could watch. I'd seen the video for Welcome to the Jungle, and all the articles I'd read in Hit Parader and Rip Magazine made me understand there was something about this band that set them apart from the otherwise tired LA rock scene. Well, the rest is history. Guns N' Roses' ramp-up was lightning fast, as we all know by now, with a string of songs embedded into a generation's DNA like, of course, Welcome to the Jungle, but also Sweet Child of Mine, Patience, November Rain, and Paradise City. To me, the Appetite for Destruction era embodied the rock and roll spirit. There was a very dangerous element to them without it being too gimmicky or put on. I think most could feel it too. But it was their incredible songwriting that put them heads above anyone else. Even to this day, Appetite for Destruction by Guns N' Roses is one of the greatest rock records ever made. In 2005, we were in Seattle, Washington, opening up for Turbo Negro at the Showbox. Backstage was none other than Guns N' Roses bassist Duff McKagan and Alice in Chains drummer Sean Kinney. I was surprised at how down-to-earth both of them were, and how cool it was that they were checking out Turbo Negro, one of the greatest bands on earth. Over the next few years, I'd bump into Duff in the farthest-reaching places, like Spain and Brazil, never really thinking I made any sort of impression on him. But he always remembered my name and was always very friendly, quite approachable. Last February, while on the Soundwave Festival across Australia, our band got partnered up with Duff McKagan's Loaded, which meant we shared plane rides, hotels, shuttles, and of course, a stage together for almost 2 weeks. In that time, I ended up on stage with Loaded singing the Guns N' Roses Appetite for Destruction classic, You're Crazy. I don't know how many times I'd heard that song, and there I was, singing it with Duff. Shortly after Soundwave, we ended up back in Seattle while on tour with Volbeat, and caught up with Duff while he was working on a film project based on his book, It's So Easy. A sit-down with him and legendary veteran rocker Tad Doyle was filmed. Hopefully the footage captured was useful for the project, and Duff also wrote a very flattering piece on our band for the Seattle Weekly, which remains the greatest thing I've ever read about our band. Do a Google search on March 21st, Seattle Weekly, Duff McKagan, Danko Jones, if you want to read it for yourself. This past summer, we ended up on tour with Duff again, this time with his other band, The Walking Papers, on the Rockstar Uproar Tour across America. Coincidentally enough, the tour was headlined by none other than Alice in Chains and Jane's Addiction, who I both saw, separately of course, at, you guessed it, Exhibition Stadium, the CNE. So, things kind of come full circle here. As stated, Duff has been writing for the Seattle Weekly for 5 years now. He also writes for ESPN.com. His autobiography, It's So Easy, is one of the greatest rock bios I've ever read. I recommend it to anyone, Guns N' Roses fan or not. Well, if you're a listener to the podcast, you probably already know Duff was on here earlier, episode number 42 to be exact, with Damian Abraham from Fucked Up. It's a fun episode, but this time, inviting Duff back, I wanted to delve into his experiences as a writer. And as a guy in a band, I look up to Duff, not just from a musician's perspective, but as someone who also needs to meet deadlines with editors while far from home on tour. I feel a kinship with him because of this. I want to thank Blue Mic Microphones for providing this podcast with the Yeti mics that we use to make this podcast happen. I want to thank Skull Candy Headphones for their Aviator headphones and the Mixmaster Mic headphones for making this podcast happen. But most importantly, I want to thank everybody who takes time to listen to even just one episode, all the episodes. Just thank you for listening to the podcast. I love this episode because Duff McKagan is the man. And this episode's guest on the official Danko Jones podcast. And it starts now.
I'm rolling already.
So. Oh shit!
No, it's
we don't want to waste tape.
No, yeah, exactly. So it's really great to have you back on the podcast.
It's good to be back.
And
Danko Jones.
This is kind of full circle because we started the year off together in Australia,
right?
And with another band of yours, Loaded.
With Loaded, yep.
And then now we're here with the Walking Papers,
right?
But I wanted to get you on the podcast because we both write and we both tour at the same time and we have editors and we have deadlines beyond any kind of tour or set list or set time or anything.
Yeah.
And I was very curious as to your process while you're out on the road and how you come up with subject matter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
You've been writing for the Seattle Weekly now for a number of years.
5 years, yep. Weekly. And it's funny, kind of came accidentally for me. In 2008, I think, I was contacted by Men's Italian Vogue to write an article for them about 1987 Hollywood. They were doing a fashion piece, like whatever that fashion was in 1987. And, I mean, the 1987 Hollywood that I remembered, I knew it was going to be completely different than what they wanted. Right. So I wrote it anyhow.
Yeah.
And I'd gone through Seattle U in my 30s and did a lot of writing because it's a liberal arts school. And I went to the business school, but I had to go. I was an undergraduate. So I did a ton of English, philosophy, religion, everything. How was the religion? You want to get into that?
No, but how was it going back to school as such a high profile, with your high profile?
Yeah,
I'm always curious when I hear people do that.
Yeah, so I was a little afraid, but I was kind of, I felt a little bold at that point. But I was afraid that I would get in. I had to jump through a bunch of hoops to finally get in the school I wanted to get into, academic hoops.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't want anything to sort of blow that opportunity I got to go to that school. And so I cut all my hair off. I dressed differently, kind of goofy. You know, the first month, you know, I was kind of afraid. And the other, they were kids. I mean, I was 33 and they were 18.
And regardless, they know who you are, though.
They knew who I was. But the school was so hard that nobody really cared. They were, you know, a couple of the kids were goofy about it, you know.
Uh-huh.
But it turned out I didn't have to be that worried about it because the school was just too hard. And when I got into the business part of the school, then it was, everybody, it was very serious. So anyhow, I matriculated through the school and VR started. And while I was in VR is when I was asked to write that article for Men's Italian Vogue.
Right.
So I wrote this piece about, you know, needles being shared and, you know, sex was still kind of that 70s hangover, like unprotected sex, unprotected everything. And AIDS was still, I mean, in 84, it was called GRIDS, gay-related immune deficiency syndrome.
Before I didn't even know that.
Yeah. And I worked at a bakery that was all gay men, except for me.
Wow.
In 84, 83 and 84. So this grid scare came in. And I had a more personal, because like friends of mine were that I worked with were terrified of this thing. And they thought it came from bathhouses in San Francisco. They thought they had it pegged to where it came from, grids. And then, of course, we found out it was. But still, wow. In Hollywood, in the heterosexual world, there was no real fear. And like the first cases of AIDS came in. Some of my, you know, people around me started to die of like overdoses. And 87 was a year of awakening for me in a lot of ways. And it was also a darkening. And I wrote about just sort of the underbelly of Hollywood that I experienced in 1987. That was my Hollywood. So I turned in the article. And the editor there really liked it. So that gave me a little bit of like, okay, I can write an article. Not that I ever thought about it before. And then the Seattle Weekly had seen that article. And I'm a Seattleite. And they asked, a column had come free. Some writer had left or whatever. And they offered it to me. It was a weekly column. So getting into what you were talking about, like, how do you... So that was, okay, a weekly column. I was in a band, and what do you want me to write about? Well, I had an editor there that talked to me about, you know, why don't you just, the first one, just introduce yourself, sort of introduce yourself. And I wrote, introduced myself, and kind of, there was some humor in it, and the second week, I don't know what I wrote, I forget what I wrote about the second week, but started to get a bit of a flow, you know. I started to get a bit quicker, and there was an audience for it suddenly. Mm-hmm. You know how those they get relinked all over the place. I don't know if Twitter was there in 2008 or not.
I don't think so.
Yeah,
I got on board on 2010, 2011.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah, 2011.
But it would get Facebooked and get picked up by other sites and all of that, and then Playboy offered me to write. They wanted me to write a financial column on their Playboy.com.
That's what I heard that too.
It's because I knew I'd gone through. So now you look at the year. It's 2008. It's 2008-9. America was crashing. The world was crashing. The financial.
Right.
You guys want me to write the financial? You want me to do? Yeah. We'd like you to try. So I kind of wrote this. So I had two columns a week that first year, and that was a. The deadlines were two different days, and I was touring, and or even if I was touring or not, you know.
And this was Velvet Revolver, right?
Velvet Revolver, yeah.
The touring is really heavy.
Yeah, but it's like what we do, you know. It's the same thing that you and I do, and you write. I like to write in the morning on coffee. That's my favorite time to write.
Same here.
You know, flash forward to now, like writing columns, like touring with, you know, the guys I tour with.
Yeah.
Whether it's Loaded or Walking Big, funny guys. And you become an observationalist when you become a columnist, when you have a weekly. You don't mean to become you're not sitting there like picking people apart and sitting back and observing, but you just, something will happen, you go, that would be an amazing column.
I was going to ask you that. Much like a stand-up comedian is always, quote-unquote, on.
Yeah.
Always trying out, at least comedian friends of mine.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you about that.
Well,
has it made you come more, like, more social, participatory in, like, conversations and stuff like that?
I think I'm less social because I'm always fucking writing. You know, I'm less social than I... like to be.
Right.
I've got a deadline, and I gotta, you know, have to turn in my whatever by I have one today. I have a deadline today.
For a Seattle Weekly?
No. Yes, for a Seattle Weekly. Yeah, for their paper. So it's kind of I'm writing about this tour.
Okay.
Because it's coming to Seattle next weekend, so it'll be in the Thursday paper.
How did the people at Seattle Weekly find out about this Italian magazine? I would think that it would have been, well, it's an ocean apart.
I think good editors, that's their job, especially if they're looking for a new columnist.
Right.
You know, I think good editors. My editor at Playboy, Tim Moore, was the guy who ended up editing my book. He reads periodicals and magazines and newspapers and different writers all the time. And that's his business.
Right.
And
it's a national paper, so they're always kind of... international magazine.
Yeah. And same with the Weekly. You know, Seattle's a very well-read town.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people just read stuff. And
right.
Yeah.
Now, with your writing, how long did it take from you starting to actually consider yourself as a bona fide journalist, a columnist, into starting to think, like, become more of a novelist, like trying to take on It's So Easy?
Right. Okay, so it's pretty simple. I wrote a column about a year into, maybe 10 months into writing for the Seattle Weekly. Now I was really starting to find my voice, and I was very comfortable writing, and I started to talk from the first person. I would tell, usually I'd write about something or this or that, interject a little bit of a personal something, but I started to write first person accounts, and some of them were maybe more emotional than I knew I was capable of writing about. And Chris Novoselic was a guy who was a peer at Seattle Weekly. He was a writer there too.
Oh, okay.
And he was a weekly columnist, and we became colleagues. You know, we were friends, and we started talking about writing. And what happened to me in 1994? I took a plane back from LA to Seattle, and Kurt Cobain was on the plane with me, and I was as fucked up as anybody was fucked up, and he was in his little deal and I was in mine, you know, a couple of days later he passed away, and I sunk into my, I was so, you know, frankly I was used to it, like people around me dying, so I didn't pick up the phone and call Chris. I didn't know him well enough, but I was, you know, because I'm a Seattle, I just felt like that was one thing I didn't do. I didn't call Grohl. Sorry about your bro. You know, I didn't do it. And I started to, I got sober, and as I was more and more sober as the years, and I started having kids, and I started to see I started to feel some things that were sticking more. Places in my life that I hadn't addressed, and that was one of them. I was calling Chris and Dave, and so I wrote a column, and it was to Dave and Chris, and it was you know, I didn't call you, man, and I'm sorry, and I'm sorry about your friend, and you know, I was on that plane, and you know, there's nothing I could tell you that, you know, I was too fucked up, like, to really. No, you know, like any sort of, like, where his head was at, or, you know, you guys probably knew him better than anybody, and you might want to ask me something, you know, but I don't know if I have anything to tell you, but I do want to tell you I'm sorry, and I'm sorry for your loss. And it was the first time I really touched on this stuff, and it was, I sent it to Chris before I went to print. I said, I just sent him an email. And it was like a letter, you know, to him. And at the end I said, I'd like to publish this in the Weekly this week. And he liked it, I think. And so I was right. That week when I wrote that thing to Chris and Dave, I wrote these other, I also apologized to my 7 older brothers and sisters about, and thanked them too for being heroes. And I named them each separately and the things they'd done, and the things maybe I wish I would have done better, and wrote a letter to my mom who had passed. And And I started just writing these. They weren't right for the Seattle Weekly, obviously, and just these side stories. And a lot of people had asked me, like, how much did you drink? How much drugs did you do? And I would put out a number. You know, I'd say, well, if I said a gallon of vodka a day, people would go, oh, that's a lot. Now, most people have no idea what that even means, right?
Yeah.
So I see this blank look on their face. So I started to write without putting any numbers to it. I took out the numbers, how much, you know, ounces, how many gallons, and about the descent into insanity, which is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then and when I did that, it was really kind of disturbing and tough to write about because I'd never really thought about that thoroughly. From punk rock kid not having a problem to, you know, somewhere between a punk rock kid and something else, and a 21-year-older, knowing he suddenly had a problem, I'll get to it next week.
Yeah.
I'll get to it next week, you know. And then being 25, fully strung out and alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
Then 29, like literally knowing that, okay, well, I'm going to die in a year or two, and being okay with it, you know, it's completely like, okay, well, that's the way it is. And then my, it's kind of my way out. I started just writing little stories, like column length stories,
right,
or sometimes longer. You're used to writing 1,000 words at a time.
Yeah.
And that's your comfort zone.
Yeah.
And you got your little peak there and your conclusion. So, I don't know. The Chris Novoselic, Dave Grohl column I wrote really woke me up, and I started writing. And I started writing a lot, and writing 4,000 words, writing on a plane flight from L.A. to New York or Seattle, London. You know, that was great. I loved those flights. I could write a lot. And but I was writing the book, and then I picked up a gig writing for ESPN, too. So I was writing for Seattle Weekly and ESPN Weekly. Playboy gig last a year, and I was kind of sick of writing about financial stuff.
Right.
I think I in the 12 months I was there, I really, there was a service that I think I did for the common man, like
I
just explaining basic stuff.
That was very strategic of them to choose you to write the column, because I think you put a face to it, just calming. Because everybody can identify with you.
Maybe so. Maybe so. And I don't know. So I had two deadlines a week, and I was writing the book. I was writing a ton. And my, you know, I don't know if you get this. You probably do. When I did my book, when my book came out, the day of release, there was a book signing, right?
Yeah.
And it was at the Strand in New York, in Manhattan.
Oh, yeah, right.
Great. It was awesome.
I love that book.
And the book company hired Dave from Rolling Stone, Dave Frick, right?
Yes. Yeah, I know that name.
Yeah. Amazing writer. He's written books, and
I'm pretty sure
I knew who he was. You absolutely have
read him.
You know what he looks like. He's been in a ton of documentaries and stuff.
Yeah.
And so back behind, before we came out, and we did a conversation, him and I, about writing before I did the book signing. In front of the people who were there. It was
right.
Killer.
Oh, yeah, right.
But before we started, I said, dude, what about your neck and your shoulders? How do you, like, he goes, so you're getting that. Do you, like, my back really started killing me just from writing so much.
How much do you write in a day? And is it a discipline for you even on this tour?
It's a discipline. It is, yeah.
You do X amount of words a day?
No. Oh, I see. No, all I have now, I'm not writing a book now, so right now all I have is one column. It's like leisurely to me. It really is.
Yeah.
And to get to that again, also, like now the funny guys in my bands, I'll sit around with them and I'm like, damn. I have a column due. We'll be on a ferry, you know, from Ireland to Liverpool or something. Like, yeah, I got to... All right, let's do top 10 something. Like, and we'll do like some goofy, and like my band will help me write my column.
Right.
And some of those are the best because you have all these ideas coming. And I'm putting, okay, give me a second. Let me put that. Does this sound right? And those have been fun to write. I've written probably about 7 or 8 of those with the help of
That's great.
My friends. But
do you stockpile stuff?
No.
If you go through, no?
No. Do you?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah. Like I'll sit on this bus. And I go, well, I just handed in this week's, and I've got next week's, but this will give me a free week to just glide. So let me just sit down here, and it takes me about 2 to 3 days to finish it when I've got like 3 weeks to hand it in. So I am a month and a half in advance with one column, and I'm 4 months in advance with another. That's a monthly column.
So who are you writing?
I do my Huffington Post,
right?
But I decided to go biweekly because I thought the weekly was just like too grinding for me.
Yeah.
And no one was asking for it. They just wanted me to contribute. And then I have a monthly column in Close Up magazine in Sweden that I've had since 06.
Jeez.
Yeah, so I do I'm 4 months ahead on that. And then I have a monthly column in Rock Zone in Spain, which is just like 500 words on an album that I like, which is I stock
any album.
It's called Danko's Hall of Fame.
Okay.
So it's just like classic records that I like. You know, like Master of Puppets or Raw Power.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I'm 5 months ahead on that.
Wow.
Yeah. So I don't have to worry about it. I can just I want to.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, from tour, and I've got other kind of writing projects that have been on the back burner for 2 years, that just stare at me when I open up my desktop, and it's bothering me. So I just want to clear the table and get to it. But they're not novels. I don't know how to be a novelist. I can't.
Well, I didn't. You know, I just wrote kind of. I didn't write a novel. I wrote a story of my life, like that I chose to tell. I didn't tell my whole story. I didn't talk about girls, and I didn't get too.
I noticed that in the book.
You know, I mean, there's just certain things. Like, I don't read that many rock books, really. I read Cormac McCarthy, and you know, I've read some rock books where it's just all about the chicks and the.
Yeah.
And it's not very gentlemanly, you know? Not that I was always a gentleman, but I think I always was actually kind of a gentleman.
And well, I think your book is different than all those other biographies because I've read my fair share. And a lot of them just go through this whole, the arc is I got really fucked up and I pulled myself from the brink and now check out my new album and here's a picture of me now.
Right.
Whereas your book went from, it just kept going and it went around. And not only did I pick myself up from the brink, I did a complete 180 and I'm doing this other, like you just kept going up, literally going up a mountain when you start talking about I think, and that takes the reader on this journey of, you know, self-fulfillment, and it's very uplifting. Like when you said, I can't remember, but it was the bike race and you even felt out of place, like just how you were dressed and you just did it.
Yeah.
You know, like stuff like that. And then you wanted to climb this mountain, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I mean, I haven't gone through what you've gone through, but everybody's been there where you want
totally.
To better yourself.
My story's not any different than anybody else. And when I wrote about the bike stories or any of that stuff, there was no intention. I literally was like, oh, that's a little too goofy to put in a book about the bike race or the you know. And it turns out like those stories, so many people recognize something about that in themselves.
But yeah, when you want to work out, when you want to get better, you like for me, when I gained a bit of weight like 6 years ago. And I was so intimidated to go into a gym, and because I just thought that everybody would be completely buff.
Right.
And it's that kind of awkwardness that, you know, is conveyed in your story there that everybody can identify with.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, so I identified with that.
Yeah, the bike race. It was. Yeah. It was funny. I mean, I just literally entered like this form at a bike shop, and sort of turned it in. And I think it was like $18 or something. It was just a thing to stay sober. If I can ride my bike every day, that's 4 weeks away. You know, and if I can make it to that, and go make it to that's 4 weeks, and. So it was way up in Big Bear. It was a journey. I had to get a bike rack for my car, and so there's steps I had to do.
Yeah, right.
But I'd never looked into bike riding culture, or clip-in shoes or the direct, any of that. I was just riding every day in the heat, and total self-flagellation thing. And I was riding in the smog up steep hills in L.A. So I thought, well, I can ride it out too if I'm riding in the smog. And I get up there, and I've got Converse high tops.
Yeah.
Cotton gym shorts.
Well, I pictured you, the way I pictured you in the GNR videos or whatever, riding a bike, feeling completely out of place.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what, especially for someone like me, what I do and where I come from, I totally feel like that. Yeah. When you do things in the quote unquote straight world,
yeah,
and you know you got a fucking skull on your shirt and you don't even realize it, and you're walking around,
yeah.
So I totally identify.
You get into that thing and suddenly you realize it, people are kind of snickering at you and all right, and a couple guys try to the race starts off and it's really intense and I'm like whoa, I never raced, you know, and some guys . One guy actually knocked me over because it was a mountain bike race. So it was you climbed up the mountain which I was fine with climbing. Like I was fit. I was fit. You know, right. I really was. I was like, I got this. But some guy knocked me over and some other, they're just gnarly. Like especially at the first couple turns, the first mile or mile and a half. It was heavy. I'm like, okay. I mean, it's just these are bike geeks, man. I got this, you know?
Yeah.
I'll take this guy down. And it was, once I kind of got my breath and kind of realized what it was and laughed at myself for feeling insecure and how goofy I look compared to
Well, that's what it is. It's massive insecurity.
Yeah, totally.
That stops me.
But, writing about that stuff, I didn't know. So Tim Moore came into it, my editor from Playboy. Right. Really cool. He's a NYU professor. He was a DJ in East Berlin, you know, punk rock. The guy's story is really cool.
Yeah.
And he's an American guy, speaks fluent German, started translating German novels into English for a book company.
Okay.
And was a DJ in Berlin and then came back and started working for Playboy. And he was my guy. He understood my whole punk rock thing and the whole deal. And so I asked, I started sending him some of my documents, either 4,000 word document or, and he was used to editing me at Playboy. So he would just send me notes. He's like, okay, document, 14. Because you send people, I have them in Word documents. So whether it's 4,000 words or 2,000 words, they're all separate documents. I kind of name them.
I see.
I don't know if you do it that way. I didn't want all of my book to be in one I didn't want to write it in one continuous thing.
Okay.
I wrote them in column lengths or for full article lengths, feature length, article lengths.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Which could be 2,500 words.
Could be.
Yeah.
And I was sending him these separate documents and he'd go, okay, well, document 14. Paragraph 3, sentence 2. What did that look like? What did that feel like?
Oh, I see. Right.
I'm like, I don't know what it felt like. Don't tell me. You know, I'd call him. I don't know what that felt like. That's what I saw. Or, hey, don't tell me. Write it.
Yeah.
You know, and so he's kind of like a professor, too, when it became time to, fill in more detail. I didn't ever go to any calendars or we didn't look on Google and look up tour dates, so I made sure I had dates of 1991 gig I was talking about, right? That wasn't the important thing. This is my memory.
Right.
I don't want to go back and try to correct it with the real story. You know, it's really my memory.
And that was the thing is with when I read the book, I knew that you wrote for newspapers and magazines. Mm-hmm. So I knew that this wasn't a ghostwriter either. Right. This wasn't you sitting in a hotel room for like 2 weekends in front of someone and someone else was writing. These were your words and stuff. So that was also different than all the other rock biographies that I've read. Right. Because sometimes I've read stuff and I'm just like, that guy doesn't even use that word in any interview I've ever heard or seen. Right. He's just incapable of that.
Yeah.
You know, no offense, buddy, but, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was very interesting.
I had to get sinus surgery for it to clear. It was kind of awesome. It was what's the word I'm looking for? It was poignant because the editing week that we were going to, he and I were going to get together and take all these stories and put them in some sort of order. Of course, the book company wanted me to like start the thing with me in the hospital and that, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm not going to do that. No, yeah. No. And my daughter Grace had just turned 13, and when that party we had for her, I talk about my daughter's party and her turning 13 at the beginning of the book, in the prologue of the book, that wasn't intentional. It just happened. And I had the book, quote unquote, written. I had all these stories written, but I didn't have a beginning, and I didn't know where to start my book. And then this party happened. And the next morning, I woke up and I looked at my wife Susan. And I said, "I think I have the beginning of my book." And it's that party last night, and here's what I thought in my head. This is what things, and so we had all these stories, me and Tim, and I had to get sinus surgery in my sinuses to clear up some old cocaine damage. This is only 2 years ago, right? But this damage started to become apparent. I was getting sick all the time, and so he came out and he goes, "Well, look, get your surgery because we're going to do it in Seattle." I wasn't with Susan and the kids. He goes, "Look, Susan and the kids don't have to come up. Get your surgery, I'll take care of you, and we'll edit your book." And it was really kind of poignant and sweet. And, you know, I'm feeling the damages from the stuff I've written about in the book.
Right.
I couldn't.
Suddenly it's like right in front of you again.
I couldn't edit my own book. I couldn't do it. I didn't know where to put the story. It was too much. I'd written it. I didn't. And I was getting frustrated, and I was in pain. And he said, "Look, I'll go down in the basement. You just stay upstairs for the weekend and I'll go down, I'll come check on you." And he worked really hard. He probably worked 16-hour days, those 2 days, and just put all these and it was really genuinely that after that first weekend, that's pretty much how it was. And he put all these stories, and it was like we discussed books that we liked, that he and I liked, and here's how I wanted the book to feel. I wanted to feel like you're going to get a panic attack by confusing you at the beginning of the book. Like, you don't know where you are. And so by the time I talk about panic attacks, you're kind of confused. You don't know where you are in the book.
Right.
And boom, here comes the panic attack that I'm having, my first one. And so that's what he did. I think the first 100 pages when he brought them to me of the book, and I read it, I was like, dude, that's just genius what you did. You know, they're my words, but they're the way he put the thing in there and put them all together was just genius. And I was suddenly super psyched to be in partnership with a guy who really knew what he was doing. Pretty cool.
Kind of like a producer to a band.
Yeah, I never had like a real... I mean, I had good producers, but, you know, like Mike Klinker, they're more like recording engineers. Songs were already written, so I never, this was kind of like what I'd thought of what a producer is, if somebody helps you with the songs and all that.
Yeah.
And he, you know, was with me the whole way and was my professor when I really had to get more detail, and the editing bit, that was completely him.
Now, are there any other plans to do another book or anything like that?
I've been toying with the idea of doing a book of my first 5 years, or the 5 years, at Seattle Weekly. Because I don't know where the Seattle Weekly's going.
We spoke about that before.
Yeah. And do a book of columns, call it 250, 250 column or something.
Is it every column, or are you going to edit out some columns where you're?
I'll
like,
edit some.
That was
yeah.
a weak. That was a weak one. Nah, I was
there's some weak ones for
you know,
sure.
I was like, oh, I was really busy that whole month. You know.
Did I really write about that?
Yeah. Do you ever reread your stuff and just go, oh, I can't believe people read that.
I'm not a guy. I should do this more. I don't go back. It's helped me, but I don't. But I think when it comes to writing and like professional writing, you should go back and look at your stuff. And I just don't do that because I'm not used to going. I don't want to go back in my life. There's some scars back there.
When it's really personal, I understand.
Right, and so I've applied that to everything else in my life. Almost, I'm just forging ahead. You know, and I got my daughters are 13 and 16, their life is going forward. So I'm up with them.
Right.
But I've written some stuff and sent it to my editor there at the Weekly. I've written some stuff I just thought was absolute crap. And then it comes out and people, you'll get 100 comments or 200 comments. Like people are like, that's just the best thing ever. And I sent it to my friends and you never know. And then you'll read it back and like, you'll read it that week. You know, like, I guess it was okay.
Yeah.
Now that you know that it's affecting people, maybe it was okay.
And then there's the other times where I remember discussing with my editor at Huffington, and he said to me, I'm really nervous about this, really nervous as to how people are going to react to this. And that got me nervous. And then when it came out, no comments. Like, I think two.
Oh,
like
zero
that's response.
Totally.
Do you read the comments that accompany your comments?
I do. I do just in case, you know, sometimes I'll know if I'm going to get comments that I should be attentive to. If it's a sensitive thing and some girl writes in like it affected her, you know, she's having problems. I'll look and make sure like everybody's okay. And then if it's something where there's somebody being a bully in the comments, which I'm sure you've seen.
Yeah.
I'll step in.
Yeah, on the Seattle Weekly site?
Yeah. And I've made everybody use their name. I wrote a whole column about I'm using my name. You know, and we are the new paradigm. Online, these are our newspapers. And newspapers started in this country, in America at least, they started on the East Coast, up in the Northeast, and there was like little villages, and they had one printing press, and they'd maybe print out two newspapers, and they would go around the whole village. Everybody would share them. In the back, there was a blank page, and you know, John Smith from, you know, 11 Squabble Lane would write his comment. But he'd put his address and he'd put his name. And he'd write his comment to some article in the paper,
right?
And they'd pass it on,
right?
And that's how the comments first started. But people would put their name and their address in little villages that everybody knew. So you took pride in what you wrote if you commented. And that became, in modern newspapers, you know, the letters section. So how did you start writing in 2006?
I did a spoken word record. And did a spoken word tour, and then the editor of Rock Hard magazine in Germany, he heard it, and he offered me a column in Rock Hard. So I think I wrote for about a year and a half, bi-monthly column, and it was a perfect start. I had 2 months to think of my next piece, and I wrote very, very lighthearted essays on rock, like, oh, you know, here's my set list for air drumming. And how to air drum properly, and like things like that.
Yeah.
And then, as my confidence grew, you do interviews with magazines and stuff. And when you're kind of like semi-impressed or impressed with whoever, you go, oh, I also do this column. And then, if you notice an opening, which I would do every now and then, I'd say, hey, I would write for you guys if you'd have me. So I ended up getting another magazine column in Norway. And then I got one in another one in Germany, guitar for the practicing musician. Mm-hmm. And then it just, then I got close-up in Sweden, which I still have. And I have carte blanche. As long as I speak about hard rock and heavy metal, and I do it in a lighthearted way. So I've always established that. I'm never going to stray from that.
Yeah.
But then when I got the, and then Huffington started a year ago, where it was a weekly thing, and I my editor said, well, you know, whenever you want, monthly, bi-weekly, bi-monthly, whenever. And I said, I could do it 2-3 times a week.
Have you seriously experimented with writing a story that's not your own?
No.
No.
I find it, I've just tried. I tried. I did two.
You did. So you did
pages.
Try.
Yeah. I just was like, this isn't me. Huh. I'm not being genuine here.
I'm reading a novel right now. It's called Beautiful Ruins, and written to 2010. I think it was it's awesome, magnificent, epic story, and it goes back and forth between 1962 and present time, and even to some other time. And I'm like, how did this? And the story, the character is so well developed, and like how did you, like, how do people like this do this?
Yeah.
And these paragraphs roll into each other. I'm like, you had to map this all out. Like, there's no way you just wrote this. Maybe there is. There's brilliant people who can write, and the writing takes them places.
I'm reading this book right now on Woody Allen, and it's just these Faber and Faber. They have this series, and I've read a few of the books in the series, but it's basically an interview, and it takes you through their filmography with the esteemed interviewer, and just trying to figure out Woody Allen's process. Much like you said, he just finishes a movie and he keeps going, and he, you know, and they talk about whatever's in the movie, but what they're not getting to, which I'm waiting till they get to, is his process as to how he comes up with these stories, like how he moves into the next story and the next, because he's very prolific, and I don't know how he goes, oh, by the time the movie comes out, I'm already like about to shoot the next one, and I never read the reviews, I'm already onto the next one. I'm like, well, how, it takes me forever, like, to come up with like a movie script. Sometimes it that's someone's life's work.
Yeah.
And you just like seamlessly go into the, I don't know how, and they have not discussed the process.
Wow.
Which is really kind of like, and considering I went to film school and I did screenwriting. Yeah.
Oh.
And I love screenwriting, the ability to do it, but I cannot, for the life of me, get out of a 30-minute screenplay. But, to do it as like he does, I don't know the process. Yeah. I'd love to know.
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah.
And the same with, like, you know, big, huge fiction pieces.
Right.
Can't do that. I don't know how to do it.
No. Then do you read fiction?
Yes, I will sprinkle it
in
with whatever I read. I'm like, I gotta get out of this. I don't care about this. The fifth person's like childhood. I don't need to hear about another person's childhood, and then I'll switch it up for a couple of books. But for the most part, I like to read, I don't know, I read a mishmash of stuff.
Yeah, I do too. I go back and forth.
But you read more history stuff from what I gather, right?
I go all over the place. When I first got sober and started reading a bunch, I read all the classics, like Ernest Hemingway, all the stuff. I was making up for lost time.
Yeah.
I read all these classics, and then I got into nonfiction, like war stuff, and then the West, and then Europe, and I'm getting polar exploration. I would just go all over the place, mountain climbing books, and I thought, well, you know, fact is way stranger than fiction. Why would I read a fiction when I've got all this stuff that happened, and these are accounts of it? I think, like you, Squires, Mike Squires from Loaded, he said, dude, you have to get back into fiction. And he gave me The Road by Cormac McCarthy. And I sat on it for like a year. He goes, have you read The Road yet? Have you read it yet? Like, no. Finally, I read it. And I it was like that book just tore me apart. I mean, that little kid, when he, you know, in the way that Cormac McCarthy writes, it's like one word, like when the kid says, okay. And that's all he says. That's all the, you know, narrative the kid has. And like, so I started, I read everything Cormac McCarthy had, you know, and so I'll do that.
And are you a book hoarder?
Do I have books?
A book hoarder? Like, I consider that like an occupation. Like,
Okay, so I have a library that I take pride in at home.
A red library. Like, all the books have been read. Cover
red.
To cover.
Yeah. They're all red. There's a couple that, only 2%, I would say, haven't been read. And it's like they were gifts or something.
Right.
Okay. They'll be read. But yeah, they're all red books that I've read. And so I have my Polar Exploration mm-hmm. section. I have World War II, World War I, all my fiction by author. I have first edition things in this cool case I have. And
that's great.
And I usually go through authors or like a period. I'll get stuck into something and,
right.
and want to know as much as I can about New Mexico, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know how to end this properly.
Well, we'll end it by saying there is no end. We're just, you and I both were like in the process of being writers.
In the process is...
Right?
Yeah.
In the process.
Yeah. There's no way that I consider myself a writer. I mean, whenever anybody says that, I go, well, the hack version of what a writer is. I always just kind of self-deprecate it, but...
I think, though, that, I mean, there's just a changing tide. I feel like you. I feel like I'm... I don't feel like a hack because I mean...
You are not a hack, no.
But you know what I mean? Like but I don't feel like that other echelon. I feel somewhere I'm just kind of making my way right now. And
right.
sometimes I write about something that I feel like that calm felt good. That felt good to write, and I think that's going to be of service or whatever.
Doesn't it feel really great when you do finish a column, you hand it in, and it just feels like very, very similar to like coming up with a great riff or mm-hmm. finishing a song?
Yeah, it's like writing a song. It's a uniquely alone thing you do if you write the song by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But writing is even more so because you're stuck in your Word document on your Mac.
Yeah,
and your wife or your kids, and nobody can, you know. They can even be sitting right next to you
yeah.
while you're writing it. And you're in this whole other thought process and headspace. And
I think it's so awesome. I love the whole feeling that I get doing it. It's addictive to the point where I think going bi-weekly has made me even miss it.
Yeah.
I might go weekly again.
Novoselic said he stopped the weekly and he told me, he goes, right before he stopped, he was really battling with it because he wanted to go back to school. And he said, I think I'm addicted to writing for the weekly.
Yeah.
I'm like, really? And now I think I get it. I'm there 5 years and like, because some columns you just turn in and like, it is addicting. I don't know if it's a bad thing. You know, necessarily, but he wanted to move on to something, and it was keeping him from moving on to some other.
But what a great thing to be addicted to!
Yeah,
because at the end of it, you're left with a body of work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is, I mean, it's great.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Is that how to end it?
It's a good way to end it.
Is it okay? Yeah. thanks, Doug.
Cool.
Thank you very much, man.
All right.
This
cool.
is something I've been looking forward to discussing with you for a long time.
I'm glad we could do this.